If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
There is a civilizational discourse that, of course, comes right up to the conquest of the New World, in which the idea is that people who are not using the land to plant crops are uncivilized and the land can be legitimately taken from them.
That was James C. Scott talking about the ways in which early civilizations developed.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. Today's interview is with the renowned political scientist James C. Scott of Yale University. He is the author of a new book entitled Against the Grain, which offers some fascinating ideas about the nature of early human societies. James spoke to our world history editor, Matt Elton, who began by asking him to outline the book's key themes.
For the last 26 years, colleagues here at Yale have run a program called Agrarian Studies, the program in Agrarian Studies. And I am actually a part-time farmer as well, raised sheep for 20 years. And we have a actually quite popular graduate seminar of people from many different disciplines who join a seminar, the title of which is The Comparative Study of Agrarian Societies. And I have given, for quite some time, I had given the first two lectures of the seminar on the domestication of plants and animals and the creation of the first states. And I was asked, I think in 2000 and, eight or nine. if I would give the Tanner Lectures at Harvard, which is a nice honor, I was pleased, but I had just finished another book and was enjoying a spell of what I call free reading without any ulterior motives. In any case, so I decided, I asked myself if I could devise a project for myself which in 3 months would produce something worthy of the Tanner Lectures. And the idea that came to me was that I knew my first two lectures on domestication of plants and animals in the first states were slightly out of date. I had updated them from time to time, but I knew that they needed work. And I thought, well, the very least I can do is to go back and read the archaeology and ancient history of the early agrarian civilizations and write two better lectures than the lectures I had been giving. The fact is, I found out fairly quickly that my lectures were, in many cases, quite wrong and misleading, and it was a little humiliating. And as a result, the actual lectures that I gave were more to register my astonishment at what I had not realized about the early forms of domestication and agriculture. And then the next 5 years were spent devising this book, which is essentially a report of all the things we now know about early agriculture and domestications, and which I include fire as well. And so it's I contribute no new knowledge. What I do is to try to assemble in a provocative way what we now know that contradicts the standard narrative that we have of civilization.
That's so interesting. So it's been quite a learning process for you, this whole thing.
Yes, a whole series of things astounded me. I think I had, like most of us, I suppose, bought the idea, obviously conveyed to me in grade school, if not somewhat later, that we managed to domesticate grains, and that allowed us to settle down for the first time and build the complex civilizations that we come to know as the early civilizations in the Middle East. I was astonished to find that the domestication of plants occurred at least 4,000 years before anything like an agrarian society came into existence, and that sedentary communities of 1,000, 2,000 or more existed long before you had anything that looked like an agrarian society. So the standard narrative of domestication of plants and animals, finally we can settle and stay in the same place, as if that's what we had been longing to do for 180,000 years of species history. That seemed to be thrown up in the air and contested and shown to be wrong in several fundamental ways.
I mean, how had we got it so wrong for so long, do you think?
That's a good question, actually, because, of course, the archaeologists have had it right for, I'm reporting back on what the archaeologists knew actually have discovered in the last 20, 30 years. So, for example, there's a place in, I guess it's in Syria, Abu Huraira, that's one of the few places in which you have a complete series from hunting and gathering and foraging to fixed field agriculture. And so in one archaeological site, you can trace this shift. And they, of course, found that the discovery of domesticated plants, the major grains, the cereals, wheat and barley in particular, occurred long before they played any major role in subsistence activities. And so the question, they understood that people avoided a kind of strong reliance on agriculture for a long, long time. And most of those people also understood that the reason why they avoided it is because both it exposed them to new risks by having a very narrow bandwidth of subsistence products, and that it was much more work. It involved a lot more drudgery. We know that pretty conclusively these days, that hunters and gatherers and foragers, even today when they're in unfavorable environments, actually spend relatively little time, less than half of their time, on subsistence activities. And they attain sufficiency without contemporary abundance, of course, rather easily. And so the reliance on plow agriculture in particular would have required a tremendous more work for a smaller return in calories, nutrition, and also a narrowing of the diet.
How does this new kind of look at things change how we understand how villages were formed and then how those formed into states?
Well, the first thing that I don't elaborate much, but it was astonishing for me, is that implicitly the assumption has been that for Homo sapiens has been around for 200,000 years, and it's only the last 10,000 years, essentially, 12 maximum, in which we had domesticated plants. And I think the assumption was that we were mobile people because of foraging and hunting and gathering, and that once we domesticated plants, we immediately wanted to settle down. The assumption being that moving mobility was onerous, was an infliction of some kind, affliction of some kind or other. And so the idea of an innate Homo sapiens desire to stop in one place and live your whole life there is built into this narrative, when in fact we have discovered, of course, in the process of colonialism and European conquest of the New World, that when we tried forcibly to settle down mobile nomadic peoples into one place permanently, we've had a war on our hands. And most Native Americans, of course, were only made into sedentary peoples on the basis of the loss of military contests and being placed forcibly on reservations. And so the idea of the desire to settle, the desire for sedentism, seems to be a crucial mistake. And the other mistake, of course, is that sedentary communities did not exist before we domesticated plants and animals.
And what were the key steps in the formation of villages in this case?
Oh, that's actually astounding for me as well. And I owe a lot of that to a great geographer, Jennifer Pournelle. And it turns out, of course, that we have this idea of the Middle East as being an arid zone in which if you have agriculture at all, you have it because of irrigation. When in fact, at 6,500 BC, the southern alluvium of Mesopotamia, and between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, was a wetland. That is to say, the sea levels were 300 feet or more above what they are today. And the result was that this was a wetland, an abundant wetland region in which it dried out partially for part of the year, but the amount of marine resources in these wetlands, the migrations of animals, birds, fish, and so on, and the different ecological zones, both a brackish water zone and a freshwater zone that shifted often, because it's a very flat plain, so the tide comes in very, very far. And the water level in Mesopotamia was much higher. It came up to the doors, if you like, of Ur and Uruk and Eridu, the very earliest agrarian civilizations. And it was this wetland abundance that made possible the creation of permanent trading settlements, basically. It's not that the people were often permanently, but they were permanent communities of traders and so on that grew to as many as 3,000-4,000, according to her.
That's quite big, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. And one thought that that would be impossible. And the fact is that there were so many ecological zones of abundance quite close to them that they didn't have to move a great deal. Now, again, we have to be careful of this assumption that people don't want to move. Most of the foragers and hunters and gatherers have periods when they disperse for certain kinds of hunting activities and other periods when they aggregate over time. And one suspects that this was the case in the southern alluvium as well. You'll notice that there was a kind of easy agriculture. It's called flood retreat agriculture. And the fact is that when the floods are at their high point, they bring silt. And then they gradually retreat into the channel of the river, and they destroy the competing vegetation. They then leave a deposit of silt, which is rich in nutrients, and all you have to do is to scatter some seeds. And so there was a kind of easy agriculture that was practiced, but it was practiced only for a small portion of the subsistence resources that people wanted.
Hmm. So for people who might not know, what sort of plants are we talking about during this period, and what impact do these new forms of living have on those plants?
Oh, that's a great question. Of course, all of the plants that we domesticate are changed in the process of domestication. Some of them in a conscious, deliberate way, and some of them in an unconscious way. So, for example, we select for certain characteristics that help us as agriculturalists. We would like, for example, the seeds to remain in their pods until we get them back to the threshing floor. And so we select for what's called non-shattering varieties in which you can cut them and take them back to the threshing floor and save most of the seed. In the wild, it's to the advantage of the plant to shatter easily and drop its seeds over a long period of time. It, in a sense, that favors the survival in the wild of that plant. We favor big seeds. We favor short dormancy so that they will all germinate at the same time. And so, like domesticated animals, actually, all of our domesticates are changed by our selection for certain characteristics over time. And in passing, I should add that one can still find in places in Anatolia stands of wild wheat that are so dense that you can actually collect enough wild wheat in a couple of weeks in order to feed a family of four for an entire year. And so these people who were not agriculturalists actually had threshing baskets and flails and sickles and so on, all of the implements, if you like, of an agricultural people, but they were using them on stands of wild grain.
So we're talking about grain when we talk about these kind of plants then primarily, or others as well?
Oh, one of the major points of the book is that all of the early states are dependent, no matter where they are in the world, on one major cereal grain, we had to add millet to that in the Yellow River Valley, but wheat and barley in the Middle East, rice, of course, in most of Asia, and millet along the Yellow River, and maize, of course, in the New World. And what's interesting to me is that we, of course, had other plants that we had domesticated including roots and tubers, lentils, chickpeas, and so on, that were domesticated at roughly the same time. What's interesting, of course, is that they were unsuitable for the taxman, and so they never became the basis of the, if you like, the state grain rationing and taxation system.
As these new states formed, who were the winners and losers?
Well, these, you mean among Homo sapiens?
Yes, yes.
Well, what's interesting, of course, is two things. I could step back very mildly to the consequences of the domestication. And so a major chapter of the book is devoted to the epidemiological consequences of this crowding of domesticated animals, domesticated plants, and human beings for the first time in really large concentrations. We have in, I think, Uruk 6,000 years ago, you have maybe 40,000 people in the same place. And this is completely unprecedented in human history, this concentration. And the consequences of this are actually all of the infectious zoonotic diseases that move between domesticated animals and human beings. So measles, mumps, chicken pox, the list could go on for almost ever. But the point is that these were diseases that simply did not exist before this crowding phenomenon of the early states and early concentrations of sedentary communities. And the disease that most of the zoonotic infectious diseases move between our domesticated animals and us over time. They jump the species gap, and it's only because of the crowding that they do this. The fact is that the domesticated animals, because they're crowded, are more likely to experience epidemics themselves. That is to say, animal flock epidemics, if you like. Human beings are likely to experience these epidemics. And because the crops themselves are similar genetic individuals all crowded together on fields for the first time, they are subject to crop diseases or crop epidemics. So the point is that these early states were extremely unstable, not only politically and environmentally, but they were extremely unstable from an epidemiological point of view. And so they often collapsed over time. And when an epidemic broke out, of course, people ran away from these early cities as quickly as they could. So to address your question of winners and losers, the point is that the mortality rates and diseases of these early cities meant that they were unhealthy places to be. Your chances of dying at an early age were greater than they were for people outside these early states. And the skeletal remains of people in the agrarian states versus hunters and gatherers show much more evidence of systematic nutritional diseases, especially iron deficiency anemia. So these were not healthy places to be, and they were therefore unstable. Of course, if we're talking about 4000 BC, the number of people in these cities as a unit, as a proportion of world population, was extremely small. These were the people in these early civilizations were almost a rounding error in the world's population. So most of the people who inhabited the globe 6,000 BC, 4,000 BC, were outside any form of state. And I argue that it's actually quite late in human history that people experienced tax collectors in most of the world, for that matter.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Given that the states were so unstable, what methods and how did leaders try to cement their power on these states?
All of the states, without exception, were slave states. And they all had a population problem. That is to say, they both had high, although they had high rates of birth, they also had high mortality rates, and they had people running away regularly. And so the problem of the early states was to replenish their population. We both know that Western European cities until the mid-19th century never reproduced themselves demographically from within their own population. There were too many epidemics. And if cities grew before we had clean water and sewage in roughly the mid-19th century, they grew by bringing in more people from the countryside. And the same, of course, was true for these early states. And so most of the wars that one discovers in these early states are what I call wars of capture. That is, they're rarely about the control over territory, because the problem is you can't grow grain very far from the palace and easily ship it and control it. So the object of warfare was, by and large, to capture populations who could be resettled back at the center as slaves or as bonded labor of one kind or another. So, for example, in the early Mesopotamian in Uruk, the symbol in cuneiform for slave is the combination of the symbol for woman and mountain. And it suggests, as we know that they did, that there were expeditions to capture mountain people, especially women and children, and bring them back and settle them at the court. Now, we're talking about maybe 9,000 people out of a total of 45,000, but that is a fairly substantial portion of slaves. These early states were quite small. When you get to Greece, of course, both Athens had a majority, a big majority of slaves. Most of them were not so visible because they worked in the quarries and silver mines that were the basis of Athenian wealth. And Sparta, of course, settled down on the backs of an existing agrarian population and essentially enslaved them. And of course, Rome was about a third slaves. So what's interesting to me about the early states is that they had this population problem that they solved by capturing people outside the state and forcibly resettling them. And in many cases, these people became full members of the community after a fairly brief period of time. It wasn't chattel slavery in the North Atlantic form that we are most familiar with, at least in America.
Mm. Do we get a sense of how people in these early states viewed people who lived outside of them?
There are two things. One of them is that people are moving back and forth all the time. So this idea that we have people inside the state and people outside the state is probably wrong for a long period during which people, depending if there's an epidemic or if there's a crop failure, people move out and take up more mobile forms of subsistence. So we mustn't think that these are hermetically sealed state people and non-state people who are not moving back and forth all the time. So people in their own lifetime are likely to have experiences of both inside the state and outside the state. That said, the official ideology of all of these states is an ideology of we are the civilized people and the people outside the state are the barbarians. And that is often linked to grain eating. That is to say, the Romans thought of themselves as wheat eaters and barley eaters, and the Gauls as consumers of animal flesh and dairy products. Of course, it wasn't quite the truth. The Gauls also planted crops as well. But if you like, the civilizational symbolism was that the people in the civilization are basically grain eaters and the people outside it are not civilized, partly because of their dietary habits and partly because of other characteristics like the clothes they wear and the fact that they move around. For the Chinese, this would be the difference between rice eaters and non-rice eaters, or in the Yellow River, between people who eat millet and people who hunt and gather outside these areas. And so there is a civilizational discourse that, of course, comes right up to the conquest of the New World, in which the idea is that people who are not using the land to plant crops are uncivilized and the land can be legitimately taken from them, the terra nullius hypothesis, in which Native Americans were seen to have no claim to the land because they weren't putting it to productive use. And productive use meant grain, as in our unofficial national anthem, the reference to amber waves of grain, which are the sign of a civilized landscape.
What kinds of cultural achievements did these very early states produce?
Oh, the cultural, I think it's completely undeniable that these concentrations of later on kingly power, merchant power, these early states produce concentrations of economic activity and trade, artisanal specializations, you know, all of the, most of the things that we find in museums, if you like, from the early civilizations are the products of these concentrations of early states and also the monumental building as well. And so the point that I make in a chapter called Collapse as Redistribution, I think I call it. There are all of these periods of dark ages when civilizations seem to disappear. It happens. It's extremely common. And these are, of course, seen as tragedies, as the blinking out of luminous centers of civilization and achievement. In fact, for most of the people in these situations, my guess is that they left these centers because of diseases or taxes or civil war and so on, and that the disappearance of the center might have been, for many of the people who then dispersed and knew how to take care of themselves when in a crisis situation, that it was actually an improvement of their welfare this dispersion. And it's recorded, of course, in history as a dark age. A dark age meaning that we no longer have all the baubles that we want to put in the British Museum and so on. So, it's interesting. Here I want to pay tribute to contemporary archaeology as opposed to historic archaeology. It used to be that, if you like, the only way you got into the history books, and that's why these early states occupy such a huge role in our ancient histories, is that if you leave all your rubble in one place, right, and you build in stone, then the archaeologists find all of your stuff in one compact place, and they're able to figure out what was going on, and this then results in museum exhibits and so on. But if, as for most of the population, you spread your trash widely and you don't leave these concentrations of monumental building, you disappear from the history books, although your history may have been in many respects, in terms of the invention of domesticated crops and Neolithic techniques, may have been actually more interesting than what was happening in the cities.
When does this part of the human story come to an end, or do you think it's fairer to say that it's actually still going on in some parts of the world?
It went on for far longer than we're likely to assume, in the following sense. That all of these early societies, states, actually before modern transportation, depended on the concentration of grain and manpower in a very small space, just because of the logic of transportation. So unless you have navigable water, which changes the calculus slightly. I'll give you an example in passing. I am told that in 1800, before the steamship, it's faster to go from Southampton, England, to the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa than it is to go by stagecoach from London to Edinburgh. I worked this out, actually. It's about true. Of course, people didn't go on stagecoach from London to Edinburgh. They went by sea. But the point is that it's very difficult to move over land, especially if it's rugged land, grain or any other important subsistence commodity, very far. And so all of the early civilizations are based on floodplains, alluvial floodplains. That is the only place in which you can concentrate monocropped cereals and human beings in one place and have a kind of surplus that a state can appropriate. Notice, by the way, that there are no taro states, no potato states, no cassava states, and that's because those crops grow underground. Although they get ripe in a year, they can be left in the ground safely and be eaten 2 or 3 years later. The advantage of cereal crops for the state is that they all grow above ground. They get ripe at almost exactly the same time. If the tax man wants them, they can come and take them, or better yet, wait till you put it in the granary and confiscate the contents of the granary. Or if they don't like you, they can burn your crops when they're ripe in the field, and you have to disperse. So in that sense, you need the cereal grains as well as this concentration of population. I'm wandering a bit, but the point is that all of these early civilizations have to have a floodplain. And so they are creatures of a particular ecology, and the way they expand is to hop through an archipelago of different floodplains. And if they colonize new places, it has to have these certain ecological characteristics, a kind of manpower grain ecological module. And let's remember that they represent now a very special new ecology in the world of the domus, the hearth, the domesticated animals, the crops, the human beings, and all of the uninvited guests who come into this ecology, the rats, the mice, the sparrows, the fleas, the ticks, all the parasites of the animals and human beings, and who find it good to eat at this particular place. And so we create a completely new ecological module by our settlement patterns. And that goes on, I think, all of the people outside these floodplains and alluvial plains are potentially beyond the reach of the state for much of human history until we get to the 16th or 17th century, I think.
That was James C. Scott. Against the Grain, A Deep History of the Earliest States, is out now in the UK and the US, published by Yale University Press. And if you'd like more global history, then don't forget to check out our new bi-monthly publication, BBC World Histories, which is available in all good newsagents and now by subscription. Head to buysubscriptions.com/worldhistories to find out how you can get it delivered to your door. Now, before we go, I've got a quick favour to ask you. We're currently running a survey to find out more about your interests in history, and it would be fantastic if lots of podcast listeners could take part. You'll find the survey at historyextra.com/big-history-survey. And if you're one of our UK-based listeners, you could win a £100 Amazon voucher. And if you're not in the UK, we would still be very keen to hear from you to ensure we can tailor our output to needs of our audiences across the globe. Well, that's about all for today, but please do listen in on Thursday, where we'll be talking about Alfred the Great.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.